It was Peter Keating's third year with the firm of Francone and Heyer. He carried his head high, his body erect with studied uprightness. He looked like the picture of a successful young man in advertisements for high-priced razors or medium-priced cars. He dressed well and watched people noticing it. He had an apartment off Park Avenue, modest but fashionable, and he bought three valuable etchings, as well as a first edition of a classic he had never read nor opened since. Occasionally, he escorted clients to the Metropolitan Opera. He appeared once at a fancy dress arts ball and created a sensation by his costume of a medieval stonecutter, scarlet velvet and tights. He was mentioned in a society page account of the event, the first mention of his name in print, and he saved the clipping. He had forgotten his first building and the fear and doubt of its birth. He had learned that it was so simple. His clients would accept anything, so long as he gave them an imposing facade, a majestic entrance, and a regal drawing room with which to astound their guests. It worked out to everyone's satisfaction. Keating did not care so long as his clients were impressed. The clients did not care so long as their guests were impressed, and the guests did not care anyway. Mrs. Keating rented her house in Stanton and came to live with him in New York. He did not want her. He could not refuse, because she was his mother and he was not expected to refuse. He met her with some eagerness. He could at least impress her by his rise in the world. She was not impressed. She inspected his rooms, his clothes, his bank books, and said only, "It'll do, Petey, for the time being." She made one visit to his office and departed within a half hour. That evening he had to sit still, squeezing and cracking his knuckles for an hour and a half while she gave him advice. "That fellow Withers had a much more expensive suit than yours, Petey. That won't do. You've got to watch your prestige before those boys. The little one who brought in those blueprints, I didn't like the way he spoke to you." "Oh, nothing, nothing, only I'd keep my eye on him. The one with the long nose is no friend of yours. Never mind, I just know. Watch out for the one they call Bennett. I'd get rid of him if I were you. He's ambitious. I know the signs."
Then she asked,
"Guy Francone, has he any children?"
"One daughter."
"Oh,"
said Mrs. Keating.
"What is she like?"
"I've never met her."
"Really, Peter," she said. "It's downright rude to Mr. Francone if you've made no effort to meet his family."
"She's been away at college, Mother. I'll meet her some day."
"It's getting late, Mother, and I've got a lot of work to do tomorrow."
But he thought of it that night and the following day. He had thought of it before, and often. He knew that Francone's daughter had graduated from college long ago, and was now working on the Banner, where she wrote a small column on home decoration. He had been able to learn nothing else about her. No one in the office seemed to know her. Francone never spoke of her. On that following day at luncheon, Keating decided to face the subject. "I hear such nice things about your daughter," he said to Francone.
"Where did you hear nice things about her?" Francone asked ominously.
"Oh, well, you know how it is. One hears things. And she writes brilliantly."
"Yes, she writes brilliantly."
Francone's mouth snapped shut.
"Really, Guy, I'd love to meet her."
Francone looked at him and sighed wearily.
"You know she's not living with me," said Francone. "She has an apartment of her own. I'm not sure that I even remember the address." "Oh, I suppose you'll meet her some day. You won't like her, Peter."
"Now, why do you say that?"
"It's one of those things, Peter. As a father, I'm afraid I'm a total failure."
"Say, Peter, what did Mrs. Mannering say about that new stairway arrangement?"
Keating felt angry, disappointed, and relieved. He looked at Francone's squat figure and wondered what appearance his daughter must have inherited to earn her father's so obvious disfavor. Rich and ugly as sin, like most of them, he decided. He thought that this need not stop him, some day. He was glad only that the day was postponed. He thought, with new eagerness, that he would go to see Catherine tonight. Mrs. Keating had met Catherine in Stanton. She had hoped that Peter would forget. Now she knew that he had not forgotten, even though he seldom spoke of Catherine and never brought her to his home. Mrs. Keating did not mention Catherine by name, but she chatted about penniless girls who hooked brilliant young men,
about promising boys whose careers had been wrecked by marriage to the wrong woman, and she read to him every newspaper account of a celebrity divorcing his plebeian wife who could not live up to his eminent position. Keating thought, as he walked toward Catherine's house that night, of the few times he had seen her. They had been such unimportant occasions, but they were the only days he remembered of his whole life in New York. He found, in the middle of her uncle's living room, when she let him in, a mess of letters spread all over the carpet, a portable typewriter, newspapers, scissors, boxes, and a pot of glue. "Oh, dear," said Catherine, flopping limply down on her knees in the midst of the litter. "Oh, dear." She looked up at him, smiling disarmingly, her hands raised and spread over the crinkling white piles. She was almost 20 now, and looked no older than she had looked at 17. "Sit down, Peter. I thought I'd be through before you came, but I guess I'm not. It's Uncle's fan mail and his press clippings. I've got to sort it out and answer it and file it and write notes of thanks, and... oh, you should see some of the things people write to him. It's wonderful. Don't stand there. Sit down, will you? I'll be through in a minute."
"You're through right now," he said, picking her up in his arms, carrying her to a chair.
He held her and kissed her, and she laughed happily, her head buried on his shoulder. He said, "Katie, you're an impossible little fool, and your hair smells so nice." She said, "Don't move, Peter. I'm comfortable."
"Katie, I want to tell you I had a wonderful time today. They opened the Boardman building officially this afternoon. You know, down on Broadway, 22 floors and a Gothic spire. Francone had indigestion, so I went there as his representative. I designed that building anyway, and..."
"Oh, well, you know nothing about it."
"But I do, Peter. I've seen all your buildings. I have pictures of them. I cut them out of the papers. And I'm making a scrapbook, just like Uncle's."
"Oh, Peter, it's so wonderful."
"What?"
"Uncle's scrapbooks and his letters. All this."
She stretched her hands out over the papers on the floor, as if she wanted to embrace them.
"Think of it, all these letters coming from all over the country, perfect strangers, and yet he means so much to them. And here I am, helping him, me, just nobody, and look what a responsibility I have. It's so touching and so big. What do they matter, all the little things that can happen to us, when this concerns a whole nation?"
"Yeah? Did he tell you that?" "He told me nothing at all, but you can't live with him for years without getting some of that.
That wonderful selflessness of his."
He wanted to be angry, but he saw her twinkling smile, her new kind of fire, and he had to smile and answer. "I'll say this, Katie, it's becoming to you. Becoming as hell. You know, you could look stunning if you learned something about clothes. One of these days I'll take you bodily and drag you down to a good dressmaker. I want you to meet Guy Francone someday. You'll like him."
"Oh? I thought you said once that I wouldn't."
"Did I say that? Well, I didn't really know him. He's a grand fellow. I want you to meet them all. You'd be... hey, where are you going?" She had noticed the watch on his wrist and was edging away from him.
It's almost 9 o'clock, Peter, and I've got to have this finished before Uncle Ellsworth gets home. He'll be back by 11. He's making a speech at a labor meeting tonight. I can work while we're talking. Do you mind?"
"I certainly do. To hell with your dear uncle's fans. Let him untangle it all himself. You stay just where you are." She sighed, but put her head on his shoulder obediently.
"You mustn't talk like that about Uncle Ellsworth. You don't understand him at all. Have you read his book?"
"Yes, I've read his book, and it's grand. It's stupendous. But I've heard nothing but talk of his damn book everywhere I go, so do you mind if we change the subject?"
"You still don't want to meet Uncle Ellsworth?"
"Why? What makes you say that? I'd love to meet him."
"Oh.
What's the matter?"
"You said once that you didn't want to meet him through me."
"Did I? How do you always remember all the nonsense I happen to say?"
"Peter, I don't want you to meet Uncle Ellsworth."
"Why not?"
"I don't know. It's kind of silly of me, but now I just don't want you to. I don't know why."
"Well, forget it, then. I'll meet him when the time comes." "Katie, listen, yesterday I was standing at the window in my room, and I thought of you, and I wanted so much to have you with me, I almost called you, only it was too late. I get so terribly lonely for you like that. I..." She listened, her arms about his neck. And then he saw her looking suddenly past him, her mouth opened in consternation. She jumped up,
dashed across the room, and crawled on her hands and knees to reach a lavender envelope lying under a desk.
"Now what on earth?" he demanded angrily.
"It's a very important letter," she said, still kneeling, the envelope held tightly in her little fist. "It's a very important letter, and there it was, practically in the wastebasket. I might have swept it out without noticing. It's from a poor widow who has 5 children, and her eldest son wants to be an architect, and Uncle Ellsworth is going to arrange a scholarship for him."
"Well," said Keating, rising, "I've had just about enough of this. Let's get out of here, Katie. Let's go for a walk. It's beautiful out tonight. You don't seem to belong to yourself in here."
"Oh, fine. Let's go for a walk."
Outside there was a mist of snow, a dry, fine, weightless snow that hung still in the air, filling the narrow tanks of streets. They walked together, Catherine's arm pressed to his, their feet leaving long brown smears on the white sidewalks. They sat down on a bench in Washington Square. The snow enclosed the square, cutting them off from the houses, from the city beyond. Through the shadow of the arch, little dots of light rolled past them, steel-white, green, and smeared red. She sat huddled close to him. He looked at the city. He had always been afraid of it, and he was afraid of it now. But he had 2 fragile protections, the snow and the girl beside him.
"Katie," he whispered. "Katie."
"I love you, Peter."
"Katie," he said, without hesitation, without emphasis, because the certainty of his words allowed no excitement. "We're engaged, aren't we?" He saw her chin move faintly as it dropped and rose to form 1 word.
"Yes," she said calmly, so solemnly that the word sounded indifferent.
She had never allowed herself to question the future, for a question would have been an admission of doubt. But she knew when she pronounced the yes that she had waited for this, and that she would shatter it if she were too happy. "In 1 or 2, he said, holding her hand tightly, "we'll be married. Just as soon as I'm on my feet and set with the firm for good. I have Mother to take care of, but in 1 year it will be all right." He tried to speak as coldly, as practically as he could, not to spoil the wonder of what he felt.
"I'll wait, Peter," she whispered. "We don't have to hurry."
"We won't tell anyone, Katie. It's our secret. Just ours, until—" And suddenly a thought came to him, and he realized, aghast, that he could not prove it had never occurred to him before, yet he knew in complete honesty, even though it did astonish him, that he had never thought of this before. He pushed her aside. He said angrily, "Katie, you won't think that it's because of that great damnable uncle of yours?" She laughed. The sound was light and unconcerned, and he knew that he was vindicated.
"Lord, no, Peter. He won't like it, of course, but what do we care?"
"He won't like it?"
"Why?"
"Oh, I don't think he approves of marriage. Not that he preaches anything immoral, but he's always told me marriage is old-fashioned, an economic device to perpetuate the institution of private property or something like that, and, anyway, that he doesn't like it."
"Well, that's wonderful. We'll show him."
In all sincerity, he was glad of it. It removed, not from his mind, which he knew to be innocent, but from all other minds, where it could occur, the suspicion that there had been in his feeling for her any hint of such considerations as applied to Francone's daughter, for instance. He thought it was strange that this should seem so important, that he should wish so desperately to keep his feeling for her free from ties to all other people. He let his head fall back. He felt the bite of snowflakes on his lips. Then he turned and kissed her. The touch of her mouth was soft and cold with the snow. Her hat had slipped to one side. Her lips were half open, her eyes round, helpless, her lashes glistening. He held her hand, palm up, and looked at it. She wore a black woolen glove, and her fingers were spread out clumsily like a child's. He saw beads of melted snow in the fuzz of the glove. They sparkled radiantly once in the light of a car flashing past. Chapter 7. The bulletin of the Architects Guild of America carried in its miscellaneous department
a short item announcing Henry Cameron's retirement. 6 lines summarized his achievements in architecture and misspelled the names of his 2 best buildings. Peter Keating walked into Francone's office and interrupted Francone's well-bred bargaining with an antique dealer over a snuff-box that had belonged to Madame Pompadour. Francone was precipitated into paying $9.25 more than he had intended to pay. He turned to Keating testily after the dealer had left, and asked,
"Well, what is it, Peter? What is it?"
Keating threw the bulletin down on Francone's desk, his thumbnail underscoring the paragraph about Cameron.
"I've got to have that man," said Keating.
"What man?"
"Howard Rourke."
"Who the hell," asked Francone,
"is Howard Rourke?"
"I've told you about him. Cameron's designer."
Oh, yes, I believe you did. Well, go and get him."
"Do you give me a free hand on how I hire him?"
"What the hell? What is there about hiring another draftsman?
Incidentally, did you have to interrupt me for that?"
"He might be difficult, and I want to get to him before he decides on anyone else."
"Really? He's going to be difficult about it, is he?
Do you intend to beg him to come here after Cameron's? Which is not great recommendation for a young man, anyway.
Come on, Guy. Isn't it?"
"Oh, well, speaking structurally, not aesthetically, Cameron does give them a thorough grounding, and, of course, Cameron was pretty important in his day. As a matter of fact, I was one of his best draftsmen myself once, long ago. There's something to be said for old Cameron when you need that sort of thing. Go ahead, get your Rourke if you think you need him. It's not that I really need him, but he's an old friend of mine and out of a job, and I thought it would be a nice thing to do for him."
"Well, do anything you wish, only don't bother me about it. Say, Peter, don't you think this is as lovely a snuffbox as you've ever seen?"
That evening, Keating climbed unannounced to Rourke's room and knocked nervously, and entered cheerfully. He found Rourke sitting on the windowsill, smoking.
"Just passing by," said Keating, "with an evening to kill, and happened to think that that's where you live, Howard, and thought I'd drop in to say hello. Haven't seen you for such a long time."
"I know what you want," said Rourke.
"All right. How much?"
"What do you mean, Howard?"
"You know what I mean."
$65 a week, Keating blurted out.
This was not the elaborate approach he had prepared, but he had not expected to find that no approach would be necessary.
65 to start with. If you think it's not enough, I could maybe."
"65 will do."
You'll come with us, Howard?"
"When do you want me to start?"
"Why, as soon as you can. Monday?"
"All right."
"Thanks, Howard."
"On one condition," said Rourke. "I'm not going to do any designing. Not any. No details. No Louis XV skyscrapers. Just keep me off aesthetics if you want to keep me at all. Put me in the engineering department. Send me on inspections out in the field."
"Now, do you still want me?"
"Certainly, anything you say."
"You'll like the place. Just wait and see. You'll like Francone. He's one of Cameron's men himself."
"He shouldn't boast about it."
"Well,
no, don't worry. I won't say it to his face. I won't say anything to anyone."
"Is that what you wanted to know?"
"Why, no, I wasn't worried. I wasn't even thinking of that."
"Then it's settled."
"Good night. See you Monday."
"Well, yes, but I'm in no special hurry, really. I came to see you, and..."
"What's the matter, Peter? Something bothering you?"
"No,
You want to know why I'm doing it?"
Rourke smiled, without resentment or interest.
"Is that it? I'll tell you if you want to know. I don't give a damn where I work next. There's no architect in town that I'd want to work for. But I have to work somewhere, so it might as well be your Francone, if I can get what I want from you. I'm selling myself, and I'll play the game that way, for the time being."
"Really, Howard, you don't have to look at it like that. There's no limit to how far you can go with us once you get used to it. You'll see for a change what a real office looks like. And Cameron's dump..."
"We'll shut up about that, Peter, and we'll do it damn fast."
"I didn't mean to criticize, or... I didn't mean anything."
He did not know what to say, nor what he should feel. It was a victory, but it seemed hollow. Still, it was a victory, and he felt that he wanted to feel affection for Rourke.
"Howard, let's go out and have a drink. Just sort of to celebrate the occasion."
Sorry, Peter. That's not part of the job.
Keating had come here prepared to exercise caution and tact to the limit of his ability. He had achieved a purpose he had not expected to achieve. He knew he should take no chances, say nothing else, and leave. But something inexplicable, beyond all practical considerations, was pushing him on. He said unheedingly,
"Can't you be human for once in your life?"
"What?"
"Human, simple, natural."
"But I am."
"Can't you ever relax?"
Rourke smiled. Because he was sitting on the windowsill, leaning sloppily against the wall, his long legs hanging loosely, the cigarette held without pressure between limp fingers.
"That's not what I mean," said Keating. "Why can't you go out for a drink with me?"
"What for?"
"Do you always have to have a purpose? Do you always have to be so damn serious? Can't you ever do things without reason? Just like everybody else? You're so serious. So old. Everything's important with you. Everything's great. Significant in some way. Every minute, even when you keep still. Can't you ever be comfortable and unimportant?"
"No."
"Don't you get tired of the heroic?"
"What's heroic about me?"
"Nothing. Everything. I don't know. It's not what you do, it's what you make people feel around you."
"What?"
"The unnormal, the strain. When I'm with you, it's always like a choice between you and the rest of the world. I don't want that kind of a choice. I don't want to be an outsider. I want to belong. There's so much in the world that's simple and pleasant. It's not all fighting and renunciation."
"It is with you." "What have I ever renounced?"
"Oh, you'll never renounce anything. You'd walk over corpses for what you want. But it's what you've renounced by never wanting it."
"That's because you can't want both."
"Both what?"
"I've never told you any of those things about me. What makes you see them? I've never asked you to make a choice between me and anything else. What makes you feel that there is a choice involved? What makes you uncomfortable when you feel that, since you're so sure I'm wrong?"
I don't know," he added. "I don't know what you're talking about."
And then he asked suddenly,
"Howard, why do you hate me?"
"I don't hate you."
"Well, that's it. Why don't you hate me, at least?"
"Why should I?"
"Just to give me something. I know you can't like me. You can't like anybody. So it would be kinder to acknowledge people's existence by hating them."
"I'm not kind, Peter."
And as Keating found nothing to say, Rourke added,
"Go home, Peter. You got what you wanted. Let it go at that. See you Monday."
Rourke stood at a table in the drafting room of Francone and Hire, a pencil in his hand, a strand of orange hair hanging down over his face, the prescribed pearl-gray smock, like a prison uniform on his body. He had learned to accept his new job. The lines he drew were to be the clean lines of steel beams, and he tried not to think of what these beams would carry. It was difficult at times. Between him and the plan of the building on which he was working stood the plan of that building as it should have been. He saw what he could make of it, how to change the lines he drew, where to lead them in order to achieve a thing of splendor. He had to choke the knowledge. He had to kill the vision. He had to obey and draw the lines as instructed. It hurt him so much that he shrugged at himself in cold anger. He thought, difficult? Well, learn it. But the pain remained. And a helpless wonder. The thing he saw was so much more real than the reality of paper, office, and commission. He could not understand what made others blind to it, and what made their indifference possible. He looked at the paper before him. He wondered why ineptitude should exist and have its say. He had never known that, and the reality which permitted it could never become quite real to him. But he knew that this would not last. He had to wait. It was his only assignment, to wait. What he felt didn't matter. It had to be done. He had to wait.
"Mr. Rourke, are you ready with the steel cage for the Gothic lantern for the American Radio Corporation building?"
He had no friends in the drafting room. He was there like a piece of furniture, as useful, as impersonal, and as silent.
Only the chief of the engineering department, to which Rourke was assigned, had said to Keating after the first 2 weeks, "You've got more sense than I gave you credit for, Keating."
"Thanks."
"For what?" asked Keating.
"For nothing that was intentional, I'm sure," said the chief.
Once in a while, Keating stopped by Rourke's table to say softly, "Will you drop in at my office when you're through tonight, Howard? Nothing important." When Rourke came, Keating began by saying, "Well, how do you like it here, Howard? If there's anything you want, just say so, and I'll—" Rourke interrupted to ask,
"Where is it this time?"
Keating produced sketches from a drawer and said,
"I know it's perfectly right, just as it is, but what do you think of it, generally speaking?"
Rourke looked at the sketches, and even though he wanted to throw them at Keating's face and resign, one thought stopped him. The thought that it was a building, and that he had to save it, as others could not pass a drowning man without leaping in to the rescue. Then he worked for hours, sometimes all night, while Keating sat and watched. He forgot Keating's presence. He saw only a building and his chance to shape it. He knew that the shape would be changed, torn, distorted. Still, some order and reason would remain in its plan. It would be a better building than it would have been if he refused. Sometimes, looking at the sketch of a structure simpler, cleaner, more honest than the others, Rourke would say,
"That's not so bad, Peter. You're improving."
And Keating would feel an odd little jolt inside, something quiet, private, and precious, such as he never felt from the compliments of Guy Francone, of his clients, of all others. Then he would forget it and feel much more substantially pleased when a wealthy lady murmured over a teacup, "You're the coming architect of America, Mr. Keating," though she had never seen his buildings. He found compensations for his submission to Rourke. He would enter the drafting room in the morning, throw a tracing boy's assignment down on Rourke's table, and say, "Howard, do this up for me, will you? And make it fast." In the middle of the day, he would send a boy to Rourke's table to say loudly, "Mr. Keating wishes to see you in his office at once." He would come out of the office and walk in Rourke's direction and say to the room at large, "Where the hell are those 12th Street plumbing specifications? Oh, Howard, will you look through the files and dig them up for me?" At first he was afraid of Rourke's reaction. When he saw no reaction, only a silent obedience, he could restrain himself no longer. He felt a sensual pleasure in giving orders to Rourke, and he felt also a fury of resentment at Rourke's passive compliance. He continued, knowing that he could continue only so long as Rourke exhibited no anger, yet wishing desperately to break him down to an explosion. No explosion came. Rourke liked the days when he was sent out to inspect buildings in construction. He walked through the steel hulks of buildings more naturally than on pavements. The workers observed with curiosity that he walked on narrow planks, on naked beams hanging over empty space, as easily as the best of them. It was a day in March, and the sky was a faint green with the first hint of spring. In Central Park, 500 feet below, the earth caught the tone of the sky in a shade of brown that promised to become green, and the lakes lay like splinters of glass under the cobwebs of bare branches. Rourke walked through the shell of what was to be a gigantic apartment hotel and stopped before an electrician at work. The man was toiling assiduously, bending conduits around a beam. It was a task for hours of strain and patience in a space overfilled against all calculations. Rourke stood, his hands in his pockets, watching the man's slow, painful progress. The man raised his head and turned to him abruptly. He had a big head and a face so ugly that it became fascinating. It was neither old nor flabby, but it was creased in deep gashes, and the powerful jowls dropped like a bulldog's. The eyes were startling, wide, round, and china blue.
"Well?" the man asked angrily. "What's the matter, Bricktop?"
"You're wasting your time," said Rourke.
"Yeah?"
"Yeah."
"You don't say."
"It will take you hours to get your pipes around that beam."
"Know a better way to do it?"
"Sure."
"Run along, punk. We don't like college smarties around here."
"Cut a hole in that beam and put your pipes through."
"What?"
"Cut a hole through the beam."
"The hell I will."
"The hell you won't."
"It ain't done that way."
I've done it.
You?
It's done everywhere. It ain't gonna be done here. Not by me. Then I'll do it for you. The man roared.
That's rich. When did office boys learn to do a man's work?
Give me your torch.
Look out, boy. It'll burn your pretty pink toes.
Rourke took the man's gloves and goggles, took the acetylene torch, knelt, and sent a thin jet of blue fire at the center of the beam. The man stood watching him. Rourke's arm was steady, holding the tense, hissing streak of flame in leash, shuddering faintly with its violence, but holding it aimed straight. There was no strain, no effort in the easy posture of his body, only in his arm. And it seemed as if the blue tension eating slowly through metal came not from the flame, but from the hand holding it. He finished, put the torch down, and rose.
"Jesus," said the electrician. "Do you know how to handle a torch?"
"Looks like it, doesn't it?"
He removed the gloves, the goggles, and handed them back.
"Do it that way from now on. Tell the foreman I said so."
The electrician was staring reverently at the neat hole cut through the beam. He muttered,
"Where did you learn to handle it like that, Red?"
Rourke's slow, amused smile acknowledged this concession of victory.
"Oh, I've been an electrician, and a plumber, and a rivet catcher, and many other things."
"And went to school besides?"
"Well, in a way."
"Gonna be an architect?"
"Yes."
"Well, you'll be the first one that knows something besides pretty pictures and tea parties. You should see the teacher's pets they send us down from the office."
"If you're apologizing, don't. I don't like them either. Go back to the pipes. So long."
"So long, Red."
The next time Rourke appeared on that job, the blue-eyed electrician waved to him from afar and called him over, and asked advice about his work, which he did not need. He stated that his name was Mike, and that he had missed Rourke for several days. On the next visit, the day shift was leaving, and Mike waited outside for Rourke to finish the inspection.
"How about a glass of beer, Red?" he invited, when Rourke came out.
"Sure," said Rourke. "Thanks."
They sat together at a table in the corner of a basement speakeasy, and they drank beer, and Mike related his favorite tale of how he had fallen 5 stories when a scaffolding gave way under him, how he had broken 3 ribs but lived to tell it. And Rourke spoke of his days in the building trades. Mike did have a real name, which was Sean Xavier Donegan, but everyone had forgotten it long ago. He owned a set of tools and an ancient Ford, and existed for the sole purpose of traveling around the country from one big construction job to another. People meant very little to Mike, but their performance a great deal. He worshipped expertness of any kind. He loved his work passionately, and had no tolerance for anything save for other single-track devotions. He was a master in his own field, and he felt no sympathy except for mastery. His view of the world was simple. There were the able, and there were the incompetent. He was not concerned with the latter. He loved buildings. He despised, however, all architects.
"There was one, Red," he said earnestly over his 5th beer. "One only, and you'd be too young to know about him. But that was the only man that knew building. I worked for him when I was your age."
"Who was that?"
"Henry Cameron was his name. He's dead, I guess, these many years."
Rourke looked at him for a long time, then said, "He's not dead, Mike," and added, "I've worked for him."
"You did?"
"For almost 3 years."
They looked at each other silently, and that was the final seal on their friendship. Weeks later, Mike stopped Rourke one day at the building, his ugly face puzzled, and asked,
"Say, Red, I heard the super tell a guy from the contractors that you're stuck up and stubborn and the lousiest bastard he's ever been up against. What did you do to him?"
"Nothing."
"What the hell did he mean?"
"I don't know," said Rourke. "Do you?"
Mike looked at him, shrugged, and grinned.
"No,"
said Mike. Chapter 8 Early in May, Peter Keating departed for Washington to supervise the construction of a museum donated to the city by a great philanthropist, easing his conscience. The museum building, Keating pointed out proudly, was to be decidedly different. It was not a reproduction of the Parthenon, but of the Maison Carrée at Nîmes. Keating had been away for some time when an office boy approached Rourke's table and informed him that Mr. Francone wished to see him in his office. When Rourke entered the sanctuary, Francone smiled from behind the desk and said cheerfully, "Sit down, my friend, sit down." But something in Rourke's eyes, which he had never seen at close range before, made Francone's voice shrink and stop. And he added dryly, "Sit down." Rourke obeyed. Francone studied him for a second, but could reach no conclusion beyond deciding that the man had a most unpleasant face, yet looked quite correctly attentive. "You're the one who's worked for Cameron, aren't you?" Francone asked.
"Yes," said Rourke.
"Mr. Keating has been telling me very nice things about you." Francone tried pleasantly, and stopped. It was wasted courtesy. Rourke just sat looking at him, waiting.
"Listen, what's your name?"
"Rourke."
"Listen, Rourke. We have a client who is a little odd, but he's an important man, a very important man, and we have to satisfy him. He's given us a commission for an $8 million office building, but the trouble is that he has very definite ideas on what he wants it to look like. He wants it," Francone shrugged apologetically, disclaiming all blame for the preposterous suggestion. "He wants it to look like this." He handed Rourke a photograph. It was a photograph of the Dana building. Rourke sat quite still, the photograph hanging between his fingers.
"Do you know that building?" asked Francone.
"Yes." "Well, that's what he wants. And Mr. Keating's away. I've had Bennett and Cooper and Williams make sketches, but he's turned them down. So I thought I'd give you a chance."
Francone looked at him, impressed by the magnanimity of his own offer. There was no reaction. There was only a man who still looked as if he'd been struck on the head.
"Of course," said Francone. "It's quite a jump for you, quite an assignment, but I thought I'd let you try. Don't be afraid. Mr. Keating and I will go over it afterward. Just draw up the plans and a good sketch of it. You must have an idea of what the man wants. You know Cameron's tricks. But, of course, we can't let a crude thing like this come out of our office. We must please him, but we must also preserve our reputation and not frighten all our other clients away. The point is to make it simple and in the general mood of this, but also artistic. You know, the more severe kind of Greek. You don't have to use the Ionic order. Use the Doric, plain pediments and simple moldings or something like that. Get the idea? Now take this along and show me what you can do. Bennett will give you all the particulars, and what's the matter?"
Francone's voice cut itself off. "Mr. Francone, please let me design it the way the Dana building was designed."
"Huh?"
"Let me do it. Not copy the Dana building, but design it as Henry Cameron would have wanted it done. As I will."
"You mean modernistic?"
"I'm... well, call it that."
"Are you crazy?"
"Mr. Francone, please listen to me."
Rourke's words were like the steps of a man walking a tight wire, slow, strained, groping for the only right spot, quivering over an abyss, but precise.
"I don't blame you for the things you're doing. I'm working for you. I'm taking your money. I have no right to express objections. But this time the client is asking for it. You're risking nothing. He wants it. Think of it. There's a man, one man who sees and understands and wants it and has the power to build it. Are you going to fight a client for the first time in your life? And fight for what? To cheat him and to give him the same old trash when you have so many others asking for it? And one, only one, who comes with a request like this? Aren't you forgetting yourself?" asked Francone, coldly. "What difference would it make to you? Just let me do it my way and show it to him. Only show it to him. He's already turned down 3 sketches. What if he turns down a 4th? But if he doesn't? If he doesn't?" Rourke had never known how to entreat,
and he was not doing it well. His voice was hard, toneless, revealing the effort, so that the plea became an insult to the man who was making him plead. Keating would have given a great deal to see Rourke in that moment. But Francone could not appreciate the triumph he was the first ever to achieve. He recognized only the insult.
"Am I correct in gathering," Francone asked, "that you are criticizing me and teaching me something about architecture?"
"I'm begging you," said Rourke, closing his eyes.
"If you weren't a protégé of Mr. Keating's, I wouldn't bother to discuss the matter with you any further. But since you are quite obviously naive and inexperienced, I shall point out to you that I am not in the habit of asking for the aesthetic opinions of my draftsmen. You will kindly take this photograph, and I do not wish any building as Cameron might have designed it. I wish the scheme of this adapted to our site, and you will follow my instructions as to the classic treatment of the façade."
"I can't do it," said Rourke very quietly.
"What? Are you speaking to me? Are you actually saying, 'Sorry, I can't do it'?"
"I haven't said sorry, Mr. Francone."
"What did you say?"
"That I can't do it."
"Why?"
"You don't want to know why. Don't ask me to do any designing. I'll do any other kind of job you wish, but not that. And not to Cameron's work."
"What do you mean, no designing? You expect to be an architect someday? Or do you?"
"Not like this."
"Oh, I see. So you can't do it." "You mean you won't?"
"If you prefer."
"Listen, you impertinent fool, this is incredible."
Rourke got up. "May I go, Mr. Francone?"
"In all my life," roared Francone, "in all my experience, I've never seen anything like it. Are you here to tell me what you'll do and what you won't do? Are you here to give me lessons and criticize my taste and pass judgment?"
"I'm not criticizing anything," said Rourke quietly. "I'm not passing judgment. There are some things that I can't do. Let it go with that. May I leave now?"
"You may leave this room and this firm now and from now on. You may go straight to the devil. Go and find yourself another employer. Try and find him. Go get your check and get out."
"Yes, Mr. Francone."
That evening Rourke walked to the basement speakeasy, where he could always find Mike after the day's work. Mike was now employed on the construction of a factory by the same contractor who was awarded most of Francone's biggest jobs. Mike had expected to see Rourke on an inspection visit to the factory that afternoon, and greeted him angrily.
"What's the matter, Red, lying down on the job?"
When he heard the news, Mike sat still and looked like a bulldog baring its teeth. Then he swore savagely.
"The bastards!"
he gulped between stronger names.
"The bastards!"
"Keep still, Mike."
"Well, what now, Red?"
"Someone else of the same kind, until the same thing happens again."
When Keating returned from Washington, he went straight up to Francone's office. He had not stopped in the drafting room, and had heard no news. Francone greeted him expansively.
"Boy, it's great to see you back. What'll you have, a whiskey and soda, or a little brandy?"
"No, thanks. Just give me a cigarette."
"Here. Boy, you look fine, better than ever. How do you do it, you lucky bastard? I have so many things to tell you. How did it go down in Washington? Everything all right?"
And before Keating could answer, Francone rushed on.
"Something dreadful's happened to me, most disappointing.
Do you remember Lily Landau? I thought I was all set with her, but last time I saw her, did I get the cold shoulder? Do you know who's got her? You'll be surprised. Gail Winant, no less. The girl's flying high. You should see her pictures and her legs all over his newspapers. Will it help her show, or won't it? What can I offer against that?
And do you know what he's done?
Remember how she always said that nobody could give her what she wanted most? Her childhood home? The dear little Austrian village where she was born? Well, Winant bought it long ago, the whole damn village, and had it shipped here, every bit of it, and had it assembled again down on the Hudson. And there it stands now, cobbles, church, apple trees, pigsties and all. Then he springs it on Lily 2 weeks ago. Wouldn't you just know it? If the King of Babylon could get hanging gardens for his homesick lady, why not Gail Winant? Lily's all smiles and gratitude, but the poor girl was really miserable.
She'd have much preferred a mink coat. She never wanted the damn village. And Wynand knew it, too. But there it stands on the Hudson. Last week he gave a party for her right there in that village, a costume party, with Mr. Wynand dressed as Cesare Borgia. Wouldn't he, though? And what a party, if you can believe what you hear. But you know how it is, you can never prove anything on Wynand. Then what does he do the next day but pose up there himself with little school children who'd never seen an Austrian village, the philanthropist, and plasters the photos all over his papers with plenty of sob stuff about educational values, and gets mush notes from women's clubs. I'd like to know what he'll do with the village when he gets rid of Lily. He will, you know. They never last long with him. Do you think I'll have a chance with her then?
Sure, said Keating. Sure you will.
How's everything here in the office?
Oh, fine, same as usual. Lucius had a cold and drank up all of my best Baz Armagnac. It's bad for his heart and $100 a case. Besides, Lucius got himself caught in a nasty little mess. It's that phobia of his damn porcelain. Seems he went and bought a teapot from a fence. He knew it was stolen goods, too. Took me quite a bit of bother to save us from a scandal. Oh, by the way, I fired that friend of yours. What's his name? Rourke.
Oh, said Keating, and let a moment pass. Then asked, why?
The insolent bastard. Where did you ever pick him up?
What happened?
I thought I'd be nice to him, give him a real break. I asked him to make a sketch for the Farrell building. You know, the one Brent finally managed to design and we got Farrell to accept. You know, the simplified Doric. And your friend just up and refused to do it. It seems he has ideals or something. So I showed him the gate.
What's the matter?
What are you smiling at?
Nothing. I can just see it.
Now don't you ask me to take him back.
No, of course not.
For several days, Keating thought that he should call on Rourke. He did not know what he would say, but felt dimly that he should say something. He kept postponing it. He was gaining assurance in his work. He felt that he did not need Rourke after all. The days went by, and he did not call on Rourke, and he felt relief in being free to forget him. Beyond the windows of his room, Rourke saw the roofs, the water tanks, the chimneys, the cars speeding far below. There was a threat in the silence of his room, in the empty days, in his hands hanging idly by his sides. And he felt another threat rising from the city below, as if each window, each strip of pavement, had set itself closed grimly in wordless resistance. It did not disturb him. He had known and accepted it long ago. He made a list of the architects whose work he resented least, in the order of their lesser evil, and he set out upon a search for a job, coldly, systematically, without anger or hope. He never knew whether these days hurt him. He knew only that it was a thing which had to be done. The architects he saw differed from one another. Some looked at him across the desk, kindly and vaguely, and their manner seemed to say that it was touching, his ambition to be an architect. Touching, and laudable, and strange, and attractively sad, as all the delusions of youth. Some smiled at him with thin, drawn lips, and seemed to enjoy his presence in the room, because it made them conscious of their own accomplishment. Some spoke coldly, as if his ambition were a personal insult. Some were brusque, and the sharpness of their voices seemed to say that they needed good draftsmen. They always needed good draftsmen, but this qualification could not possibly apply to him, and would he please refrain from being rude enough to force them to express it more plainly? It was not malice. It was not a judgment passed upon his merit. They did not think he was worthless. They simply did not care to find out whether he was good. Sometimes he was asked to show his sketches. He extended them across a desk, feeling a contraction of shame in the muscles of his hand. It was like having the clothes torn off his body. And the shame was not that his body was exposed, but that it was exposed to indifferent eyes. Once in a while he made a trip to New Jersey to see Cameron. They sat together on the porch of a house on a hill, Cameron in a wheelchair, his hands on an old blanket spread over his knees.
How is it, Howard? Pretty hard?
No.
Want me to give you a letter to one of the bastards?
No.
Then Cameron would not speak of it anymore. He did not want to speak of it. He did not want the thought of Rourke rejected by their city to become real.
When Rourke came to him, Cameron spoke of architecture with the simple confidence of a private possession. They sat together, looking at the city in the distance, on the edge of the sky, beyond the river. The sky was growing dark and luminous as blue-green glass. The buildings looked like clouds condensed on the glass, gray-blue clouds frozen for an instant in straight angles and vertical shafts, with the sunset caught in the spires. As the summer months passed, as his list was exhausted and he returned again to the places that had refused him once, Rourke found that a few things were known about him, and he heard the same words, spoken bluntly, or timidly, or angrily, or apologetically. You were kicked out of Stanton. You were kicked out of Francone's office. All the different voices saying it had one note in common, a note of relief in the certainty that the decision had been made for them. He sat on the windowsill in the evening, smoking, his hands spread on the pane, the city under his fingers, the glass cold against his skin. In September, he read an article entitled Make Way for Tomorrow by Gordon L. Prescott, AGA, in the Architectural Tribune. The article stated that the tragedy of the profession was the hardships placed in the way of its talented beginners, that great gifts had been lost in the struggle unnoticed, that architecture was perishing from a lack of new blood and new thought, a lack of originality, vision, and courage, that the author of the article made it his aim to search for promising beginners to encourage them, develop them, and give them the chance they deserved. Rourke had never heard of Gordon L. Prescott, but there was a tone of honest conviction in the article. He allowed himself to start for Prescott's office with the first hint of hope. The reception room of Gordon L. Prescott's office was done in gray, black, and scarlet. It was correct, restrained, and daring all at once. A young and very pretty secretary informed Rourke that one could not see Mr. Prescott without an appointment, but that she would be very glad to make an appointment for next Wednesday at 2:15. On Wednesday at 2:15, the secretary smiled at Rourke and asked him, please to be seated for just a moment. At 4:45, he was admitted into Gordon L. Prescott's office. Gordon L. Prescott wore a brown checkered tweed jacket and a white turtleneck sweater of Angora wool. He was tall, athletic, and 35, but his face combined a crisp air of sophisticated wisdom with the soft skin, the button nose, the small puffed mouth of a college hero. His face was sun-scorched, his blonde hair clipped short in a military Prussian haircut. He was frankly masculine, frankly unconcerned about elegance, and frankly conscious of the effect. He listened to Rourke silently, and his eyes were like a stopwatch, registering each separate second consumed by each separate word of Rourke's. He let the first sentence go by. On the second, he interrupted to say curtly, "Let me see your drawings," as if to make it clear that anything Rourke might say was quite well known to him already. He held the drawings in his bronzed hands. Before he looked down at them, he said, "Ah, yes, so many young men come to me for advice. So many." He glanced at the first sketch, but raised his head before he had seen it. "Of course, it's the combination of the practical and the transcendental that is so hard for beginners to grasp." He slipped the sketch to the bottom of the pile. "Architecture is primarily a utilitarian conception, and the problem is to elevate the principle of pragmatism into the realm of aesthetic abstraction. All else is nonsense." He glanced at two sketches and slipped them to the bottom. "I have no patience with visionaries who see a holy crusade in architecture for architecture's sake. The great dynamic principle is the common principle of the human equation." He glanced at a sketch and slipped it under. "The public taste and the public heart are the final criteria of the artist. The genius is the one who knows how to express the general. The exception is to tap the unexceptional." He weighed the pile of sketches in his hand, noted that he had gone through half of them, and dropped them down on the desk. "Ah, yes," he said. "Your work. Very interesting. But not practical, not mature, unfocused and undisciplined. Adolescent. Originality for originality's sake, not at all in the spirit of the present day. If you want an idea of the sort of thing for which there is a crying need, here, let me show you." He took a sketch out of a drawer of the desk. "Here's a young man who came to me totally unrecommended. A beginner who had never worked before. When you can produce stuff like this, you won't find it necessary to look for a job. I saw this one sketch of his, and I took him on at once. Started him at 25 a week, too. There's no question but that he is a potential genius. He extended the sketch to Rourke. The sketch represented a house in the shape of a grain silo, incredibly merged with the simplified, emaciated shadow of the Parthenon.
That, said Gordon L. Prescott, is originality, the new in the eternal. Try toward something like this. I can't really say that I predict a great deal for your future. We must be frank. I wouldn't want to give you illusions based on my authority. You have a great deal to learn. I couldn't venture a guess on what talent you might possess or develop later, but with hard work, perhaps. Architecture is a difficult profession, however, and the competition is stiff, you know, very stiff. And now, if you'll excuse me, my secretary has an appointment waiting for me.
Rourke walked home late on an evening in October. It had been another of the many days that stretched into months behind him, and he could not tell what had taken place in the hours of that day, whom he had seen, what form the words of refusal had taken. He concentrated fiercely on the few minutes at hand when he was in an office, forgetting everything else. He forgot these minutes when he left the office. It had to be done. It had been done. It concerned him no longer. He was free once more on his way home. A long street stretched before him, its high banks coming close together ahead, so narrow that he felt as if he could spread his arms, seize the spires, and push them apart. He walked swiftly, the pavements as a springboard, throwing his steps forward. He saw a lighted triangle of concrete suspended somewhere hundreds of feet above the ground. He could not see what stood below, supporting it. He was free to think of what he'd want to see there, what he would have made to be seen. Then he thought suddenly that now, in this moment, according to the city, according to everyone save that hard certainty within him, he would never build again, never, before he had begun. He shrugged. Those things happening to him in those offices of strangers were only a kind of sub-reality, unsubstantial incidents in the path of a substance they could not reach or touch. He turned into side streets leading to the East River. A lonely traffic light hung far ahead, a spot of red in a bleak darkness. The old houses crouched low to the ground, hunched under the weight of the sky. The street was empty and hollow, echoing to his footsteps. He went on, his collar raised, his hands in his pockets. His shadow rose from under his heels when he passed a light, and brushed a wall in a long black arc, like the sweep of a windshield wiper.
Chapter 9. John Eric Snite looked through Rourke's sketches, flipped three of them aside, gathered the rest into an even pile, glanced again at the three, tossed them down one after another on top of the pile with three sharp thuds, and said,
"Remarkable, radical, but remarkable. What are you doing tonight?"
"Why?" asked Rourke, stupefied.
"Are you free? Mind starting in at once? Take your coat off, go to the drafting room, borrow tools from somebody, and do me up a sketch for a department store we're remodeling. Just a quick sketch, just a general idea, but I must have it tomorrow. Mind staying late tonight? The heat's on, and I'll have Joe send you up some dinner. Want black coffee or scotch or what? Just tell Joe. Can you stay?"
"Yes," said Rourke incredulously. "I can work all night."
"Fine, splendid. That's just what I've always needed, a Cameron man. I've got every other kind. Oh, yes, what did they pay you at Francone's?"
"65.
"Well, I can't splurge like Guy the Epicure. 50's tops, okay?" "Fine, go right in. I'll have Billings explain about the store to you. I want something modern, understand, modern, violent, crazy, to knock their eye out. Don't restrain yourself, go the limit. Pull any stunt you can think of, the goofier the better. Come on."
John Eric Snite shot to his feet, flung a door open into a huge drafting room, flew in, skidded against a table, stopped, and said to a stout man with a grim moon face,
"Billings, Rourke, he's our modernist. Give him the Benton store. Get him some instruments. Leave him your keys and show him what to lock up tonight. Start him as of this morning, 50. What time was my appointment with Dolson Brothers? I'm late already. So long. I won't be back tonight."
He skidded out, slamming the door. Billings evinced no surprise. He looked at Rourke as if Rourke had always been there. He spoke impassively in a weary drawl. Within 20 minutes he left Rourke at a drafting table with paper, pencils, instruments, a set of plans and photographs of the department store, a set of charts, and a long list of instructions. Rourke looked at the clean white sheet before him, his fist closed tightly about the thin stem of a pencil. He put the pencil down and picked it up again,
his thumb running softly up and down the smooth shaft. He saw that the pencil was trembling. He put it down quickly, and he felt anger at himself for the weakness of allowing this job to mean so much to him, for the sudden knowledge of what the months of idleness behind him had really meant. His fingertips were pressed to the paper, as if the paper held them, as a surface charged with electricity will hold the flesh of a man who has brushed against it, hold and hurt. He tore his fingers off the paper. Then he went to work. John Eric Snite was 50 years old. He wore an expression of quizzical amusement, shrewd and unwholesome, as if he shared with each man he contemplated a lewd secret which he would not mention because it was so obvious to them both. He was a prominent architect. His expression did not change when he spoke of this fact. He considered Guy Francone an impractical idealist. He was not restrained by any classic dogma. He was much more skillful and liberal. He built anything. He had no distaste for modern architecture, and built cheerfully, when a rare client asked for it, bare boxes with flat roofs, which he called progressive. He built Roman mansions, which he called fastidious. He built Gothic churches, which he called spiritual. He saw no difference among any of them. He never became angry, except when somebody called him eclectic. He had a system of his own. He employed 5 designers of various types, and he staged a contest among them on each commission he received. He chose the winning design and improved it with bits of the 4 others. 6 minds, he said, are better than one. When Rourke saw the final drawing of the Benton department store, he understood why Snite had not been afraid to hire him. He recognized his own planes of space, his windows, his system of circulation. He saw, added to it, Corinthian capitals, Gothic vaulting, colonial chandeliers, and incredible moldings, vaguely Moorish. The drawing was done in watercolor with miraculous delicacy, mounted on cardboard, covered with a veil of tissue paper. The men in the drafting room were not allowed to look at it except from a safe distance. All hands had to be washed, all cigarettes discarded. John Eric Snite attached a great importance to the proper appearance of a drawing for submission to clients, and kept a young Chinese student of architecture employed solely upon the execution of these masterpieces. Rourke knew what to expect of his job. He would never see his work erected, only pieces of it, which he preferred not to see. But he would be free to design as he wished, and he would have the experience of solving actual problems. It was less than he wanted, and more than he could expect. He accepted it at that. He met his fellow designers, the 4 other contestants, and learned that they were unofficially nicknamed in the drafting room as Classic, Gothic, Renaissance, and Miscellaneous. He winced a little when he was addressed as, "Hey, Modernistic!" The strike of the building trades unions infuriated Guy Francone. The strike had started against the contractors who were erecting the Noyes Belmont Hotel, and had spread to all the new structures of the city. It had been mentioned in the press that the architects of the Noyes Belmont with the firm of Francone and Heyer. Most of the press helped the fight along, urging the contractors not to surrender. The loudest attacks against the strikers came from the powerful papers of the great Winand chain. "We have always stood," said the Winand editorials, "for the rights of the common man against the yellow sharks of privilege, but we cannot give our support to the destruction of law and order." It had never been discovered whether the Winand papers led the public or the public led the Winand papers. It was known only that the two kept remarkably in step. It was not known to anyone, however, save to Guy Francone and a very few others, that Gail Winand owned the corporation which owned the corporation which owned the Noyes Belmont Hotel. This added greatly to Francone's discomfort. Gail Winand's real estate operations were rumored to be vaster than his journalistic empire. It was the first chance Francone had ever had at a Winand commission, and he grasped it avidly, thinking of the possibilities which it could open. He and Keating had put their best efforts into designing the most ornate of all Rococo palaces for future patrons who could pay $25 per day per room, and who were fond of plaster flowers, marble cupids, and open elevator cages of bronze lace. The strike had shattered the future possibilities. Francone could not be blamed for it, but one could never tell whom Gail Winand would blame, and for what reason. The unpredictable, unaccountable shifts of Winand's favor were famous, and it was well known that few architects he employed once were ever employed by him again. Francone's sullen mood led him to the unprecedented breach of snapping over nothing in particular at the one person who had always been immune from it, Peter Keating. Keating shrugged and turned his back to him in silent insolence. Then Keating wandered aimlessly through the halls, snarling at young draftsmen without provocation. He bumped into Lucius N. Heyer in a doorway and snapped, "Look where you're going!" Heyer stared after him, bewildered, blinking. There was little to do in the office, nothing to say, and everyone to avoid. Keating left early and walked home through a cold December twilight. At home, he cursed aloud the thick smell of paint from the overheated radiators. He cursed the chill when his mother opened a window. He could find no reason for his restlessness, unless it was the sudden inactivity that left him alone. He could not bear to be left alone. He snatched up the telephone receiver and called Catherine Halsey. The sound of her clear voice was like a hand pressed soothingly against his hot forehead. He said, "Oh, nothing important, dear. I just wondered if you'd be home tonight. I thought I'd drop in after dinner." "Of course, Peter. I'll be home." "Swell. About 8:30? "Yes." "Oh, Peter, have you heard about Uncle Ellsworth?"
"Yes, goddammit, I've heard about your Uncle Ellsworth."
"I'm sorry, Katie. Forgive me, darling, I didn't mean to be rude. But I've been hearing about your uncle all day long.
I know it's wonderful and all that. Only, look, we're not going to talk about him again tonight."
"No, of course not. I'm sorry. I understand. I'll be waiting for you."
"So long, Katie."
He had heard the latest story about Ellsworth Toohey, but he did not want to think of it because it brought him back to the annoying subject of the strike. 6 months ago, on the wave of his success with Sermons in Stone, Ellsworth Toohey had been signed to write One Small Voice, a daily syndicated column for the Wynand papers. It appeared in the Banner and had started as a department of art criticism, but grown into an informal tribune from which Ellsworth M. Toohey pronounced verdicts on art, literature, New York restaurants, international crises, and sociology. Mainly sociology. It had been a great success. But the building strike had placed Ellsworth M. Toohey in a difficult position. He made no secret of his sympathy with the strikers, but he had said nothing in his column, for no one could say what he pleased on the papers owned by Gail Wynand, save Gail Wynand. However, a mass meeting of strike sympathizers had been called for this evening. Many famous men were to speak, Ellsworth Toohey among them. At least, Toohey's name had been announced. The event caused a great deal of curious speculation, and bets were made on whether Toohey would dare to appear. "He will," Keating had heard a draftsman insist vehemently. "He'll sacrifice himself. He's that kind. He's the only honest man in print."
"He won't," another had said. "Do you realize what it means to pull a stunt like that on Wynand? Once Wynand gets it in for a man, he'll break the guy sure as hell's fire. Nobody knows when he'll do it or how he'll do it, but he'll do it. And nobody'll prove a thing on him. And you're done for once you get Wynand after you."
Keating did not care about the issue one way or another, and the whole matter annoyed him. He ate his dinner that evening in grim silence, and when Mrs. Keating began with an,
"Oh, by the way,"
to lead the conversation in a direction he recognized, he snapped, "You're not going to talk about Catherine. Keep still." Mrs. Keating said nothing further, and concentrated on forcing more food on his plate. He took a taxi to Greenwich Village. He hurried up the stairs. He jerked at the bell. He waited. There was no answer. He stood leaning against the wall, ringing for a long time. Catherine wouldn't be out when she knew he was coming. She couldn't be.